Good evening and welcome to Art Waves. I'm Bernadette Rule, and tonight my guest is Alan Walker. Alan Walker is Professor Emeritus of Music at McMaster University, Canada. Before settling in North America, he was on the staff of the Music Division of the British Broadcasting Corporation in London. He has broadcast for the BBC, the CBC, and for CJRTFM in Toronto, and he gives regular public lectures on the music of the Romantic era, a period in which he specializes. His 13 published books include A Study in Musical Analysis, An Anatomy of Musical Criticism, and symposia on Chopin, Schumann, and Liszt. Alan Walker's latest book is a long-awaited biography of Hans von Bülow, Franz Liszt's leading pupil, and the world's first virtuoso orchestral conductor. But Dr. Walker is perhaps best known for his definitive three-volume prize-winning biography of Franz Liszt, a project which took him 25 years to complete. Welcome to Art Waves, Alan Walker.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here.
It is wonderful to have you here. As noted, now you are primarily known for your biography of Franz Liszt, and we're going to focus on that momentous work tonight. But your most recent biography of Hans von Bülow, Liszt's most notable student, tell me to what extent that was simply a way for you to continue your long fascination with Liszt himself.
It was basically a way to continue my fascination with Liszt. I came across the personality of Bülow when I was writing my Liszt biography, and it always seemed to me that he was so important as a musician, he deserved his own biography. And there was not a biography of Bülow in the English language. He was not only Liszt's favorite pupil and perhaps his best piano pupil, he was also Liszt's son-in-law, because he married Cosima, Liszt's second daughter. That marriage ended in tragedy, of course, when Richard Wagner came along and perceived the wonderful qualities in Hans von Bülow as a potential conductor at Bayreuth, brought Bülow into his orbit, and Bülow gave the world premieres of Tristan and then Meistersinger, and thereafter he disappears from Wagner's life, just as he had disappeared from Liszt's life. And he became marginalized in the life stories of both those great composers. So I decided that I would like to write a biography of Bülow, and I discovered a tremendous archive in Berlin's Staatsbibliothek, which had been put together by Bülow's second wife. And I spent about 5 years working on this book, and the result was published about 4 years ago. And I have to say that I enjoyed every moment that I worked on it.
Well, I'm sure you did. It took you back to some of the places that you had been when you were exploring Liszt's life, did it?
It certainly took me back to Berlin, and it took me back to Weimar. But mostly it took me to new places like Meiningen, where Bülow had served as a conductor for a good many years, and also to the United States, because Bülow, as a concert pianist, he did no fewer than 3 tours of the USA. The first tour, I think he gave something like 140 recitals, starting in Boston and going right down to the Deep South before we had a nervous breakdown.
Oh,
and he had to come back to New York, and then finally they shipped him back to Germany in order to recover.
Oh, my gosh.
And thereafter, he became very well known as an orchestral conductor and ended up as the first artistic director of the newly formed Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra.
Mm. We do have a tendency to wear our musicians out, don't we? It's terrible. The poor things. You're always hearing of them having a total breakdown with just the constant touring.
Yes.
Tell me about some other ways into Liszt's life and work and character that you're working on now or have going on.
Well, I suppose the last book that I published dealing with Liszt was called Reflections on Liszt, and it was basically a series of essays devoted to such topics as Liszt and the Schubert song transcriptions, Liszt and the Beethoven symphonies, Liszt as an editor of other composers' music, and Liszt as an author. All the topics that basically I didn't have time to deal with when I was writing the biography.
large volumes, you did not have time
yes.
to deal with everything.
So basically, wow. That book was a kind of fourth volume, an extension of the earlier biography. And I'm presently working on an extension of that book, a kind of series 2 of essays, which will contain articles about Liszt's Faust Symphony, his greatest orchestral work, and, of course, the great Christus Oratorio, 3.5 hours long. It's a vast work, hardly ever performed. But these works interest me, and I wanted to write a book about them.
Oh, my goodness. Can you ever imagine getting bored with Liszt, being filled to the top with him?
Well, hardly, because Liszt was such a fascinating personality. I've often thought in my imagination it would have been very nice to take Liszt out to dinner. He loved wining and dining, and I can see him now with his long gray hair, his abbé's collar, the seven distinguished warts marking his face, the penetrating eyes, the shaggy eyebrows. I would wait, I think, until he'd had his second cognac before asking him the all-important question that I suppose all pianists want to ask a pianist like Liszt. Master, give us the keys to the kingdom. Where did you develop your fantastic technique? I think Liszt might pause. He would draw on his cigar. He was an inveterate cigar smoker. And then he would give me an answer that I think the world at large might find astonishing. He would say that technique should flow from spirit and not from mechanics. In other words, he would be saying, you can run up and down the keyboard every day all your life. You can play fast and loud, but you will never develop the transcendental technique required to play music as it should be played unless your technique flows from a spiritual part of your being and not merely the physical. I would wait, I suppose, until I digested that answer, and then I would have another one for him. Master, how is the artistic personality formed? And again, I think he would give us a reply that would astonish us, that the way to improve the artistic personality is, first of all, to develop the human personality. When we go to a concert to hear a great artist play the violin or to sing or to play the piano, we want to hear more than someone playing the violin, playing the piano, and singing. We want to hear a human being using music to transmit human experience. And one can only do that if the artist in question has lived a full life in the way that Liszt himself had lived it. And my final question, because my dinner time with Liszt, I suppose, would be running out at this point, would be to ask Liszt what was the place of music in society. And I think he would say that music functions best when it's placed in the service of some ethical or humanitarian cause, as Liszt himself used to place his music. A river of gold poured in Liszt's lifetime, but a river of gold also poured out, and he gave money to many charitable causes until at the end of his life, he was only just able to survive. Mm. He had no money. Money was not important to him, nor was celebrity. Money is only important, and celebrity is only important, if you can put celebrity and money to use. And that is what Liszt always tried to do. There's a touching story told by one of his pupils, Janka Vol. He went to Hungary. Janka Vol invited him to her apartment. And she remembered vividly, even before Liszt had unpacked, that she had handed him a whole sheaf of envelopes. And he sat down, and he filled each envelope with money and addressed the envelope to people that he'd never even heard of because they were begging him for money. They knew that he was, I suppose today we would call Liszt a soft touch. Hmm. But he liked to help people wherever he could. Now, that's a very long answer to one of your shortest questions.
My gosh, what a wonderful answer, though. I love that you have imagined this dinner with him and this conversation and both sides of the conversation. What were you eating?
Well, you see...
I have to know.
Well, his favorite dessert was gooseberry pie. We know that because he himself said so. He liked ice cream as well. Towards the end of his life, he would have to eat soft foods because he had dental problems and he couldn't really chew meat and hard foods very easily. Mm. But he certainly loved soup, and wherever it was possible, he liked to have chicken as well. They were his favorite meals. Well, but said, just going back a moment,
yes.
Lest our listeners should accuse me of putting words into Liszt's mouth, I just want everyone to know that the answers I gave, coming from Liszt's mouth, were Liszt's own answers to the questions that had been put to him earlier by his first biographer, Lina Rahman. She asked him those very questions, and the answers I gave were his.
You know, I have not a second's doubt that the answers are his, Alan Walker, because you seem to know more about Liszt than any other human being on the planet, and I feel sure you would be able to anticipate, even if he hadn't been asked them, what he might say, most likely would say, to almost any question. It's fascinating. I really should be interviewing Liszt tonight. I have this opportunity, and you're like a medium. It's fabulous. All right. So, Alan Walker, you say in your very revealing article from the 2011 Hungarian Quarterly, which is entitled Franz Liszt, A Biographer's Journey, on page one, you say that you were always, quote, always attracted to Liszt's personality and to, quote, the legend of his piano playing as to few other topics. Now, how did you come to be introduced to Liszt in your childhood?
You can't really go very far in piano playing without coming across the name of Liszt. And I started playing the piano at about the age of nine, I suppose, or the age of eight, certainly no later than nine. Rather late to entertain ambitions to become a concert pianist, but the piano was central to my early life, and I spent most of my spare time playing and practicing the piano until I suppose I was about 25, which of course introduced me to most of the standard repertory of the piano. This knowledge has stood me in very good stead. I came across Liszt, I suppose, in a serious way when I was about 10 or 11, and I fell in love with his Third Liebestraum, a very famous piano piece, and also together with that, the Second Hungarian Rhapsody. So, of course, I rushed out to buy the music, and I was deeply disappointed and frustrated when I realized they had cadenzas and I was incapable of playing them. These pieces, although they're popular, are extremely hard for beginning pianists. So that rather put me off for a few years, and I returned to my Mozart and Beethoven and Schubert
before
returning to Liszt. And I returned to Liszt, of course, when I joined the BBC. And that gave me the opportunity to meet some of the world's greatest pianists, and I worked with them for a period of about 10 years. Wilhelm Backhaus, Arthur Rubinstein, Louis Kentner, John Ogden, they all came into the BBC studios and I produced them. They took part in a big Liszt piano series that I organized for the BBC, and that actually opened the door to my Liszt biography, because after I'd finished recording all those recitals, I suppose there were about 15 of them altogether, of recitals lasting for 90 or 120 minutes each, I had to write the program notes for the announcers, and I realized there were no good books on Liszt to enable me to do this. So that fired me with the enthusiasm to write a biography of my own. That's basically how it all started.
Okay. Well, I want you to go back to the phrase that you use in the Hungarian Quarterly article, the legend of his piano playing. What do you mean by that?
The legend of Liszt's piano playing rests not on imagination, but on solid facts. Liszt was the first pianist in history to play his recitals from memory. He was the first to place the piano at right angles to the stage so that the open lid throws out the sound across the auditorium. His critics accused him of wanting to show off his beautiful profile, but in fact, his decision to put the piano in that position was rested purely on acoustics and music.
And was wise.
He was the first to tour Europe from the Pyrenees Mountains in the west to the Ural Mountains in the east. He gave well over 1,000 recitals in that fleeting period we call his years of transcendental execution, which lasted about 8 years, no more. And then, of course, he invented the term recital. And the very first time we see it in print on the front page of the London Times was June 9th of 1840. Monsieur Liszt is going to recite on the piano. How can one recite on the piano, his critics said. So everyone went to the concert to find out. What Liszt was actually saying is that he was going to introduce a new note of rhetoric into musical performance. A year earlier, he had wheeled his piano onto the vast stage of the Milan Opera House, and he'd given a solo concert to more than 3,000 people. And he wrote a letter to Pierre Erard the following morning, because Erard had loaned him a piano for this event, and thereafter Liszt was always an Erard pianist. And he said, now you can say to the whole world that your piano is capable of filling this vast opera house, and I'm able to recite on this instrument. So that's basically how we come to have the modern recital today, and all the things that we associate with it, everything goes back to Liszt.
Oh my goodness. Well, it is fascinating that he did so much of this, because we know Mozart and Beethoven and so on, they gave concerts too. But they were turned with their backs to the audience?
Well, if you look at the iconography, it's strange how the piano is often pushed to the back, or it's pushed to the side of an orchestra, or no consideration whatsoever has been given to where it sounds best. But Liszt quickly discovered that you have to do more than play the piano. You have to play the building. The building is an acoustical instrument. If it's well built, it's a very good instrument. And depending where you put the piano, you can have that instrument work for you. If you put the piano in the wrong place, it will work against you. And we all have examples of that around us. There's an example right here in Hamilton, where if you give a solo piano recital in Hamilton Place, you're very lucky if you're even sitting in the middle of the auditorium to hear what's going on. There are places that you can put the piano, and also places where you can sit, which give you a better sound than other seating areas in the building.
Okay. Mm. All right, so obviously you yourself are a musician and passionate about being a musician. How important is it for the biographer of a musician to be a musician, him or herself?
Well, if by biography you simply mean where a person is born, who they married, what they had for lunch, and what they did for a hobby, and when they died, how many children they had, so on and so forth, anyone, if they can write a decent biography. But if by biography you mean a narrative that takes in the very reason why the choice of that subject as the subject of a biography, if you take that into account, you have to be a musician. And it's very important in the case of the writer to know that the work is a part of the life, and yes, you have to embrace everything.
In this case, a key part of the life.
Yes. The same would apply if you were writing a life of Rembrandt or a life of Shakespeare. It would really be impossible to keep the paintings or the plays out of the picture, and you'd have to know what you were talking about if you wanted to introduce them into the picture, because this is what makes these people interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Now, your writing itself, as our listeners will already know by listening to you talk, your writing is very witty and engaging. I would love it if you could read for us a passage, Alan Walker, from your trilogy of Franz Liszt, so that they can hear you.
Well, the passage I've chosen comes from the first volume of my Life of Liszt, and it has to do with Liszt and the keyboard. And it begins: "Whatever else the world may debate about his life and work, one thing is generally conceded. Liszt was the first modern pianist. The technical breakthrough he achieved during the 1830s and 40s was without precedent in the history of the piano. All subsequent schools were branches of his tree. Rubinstein, Busoni, Paderewski, Godowsky, and Rachmaninoff, all those pianists who together formed what historians later dubbed the golden age of piano playing, would be unthinkable without Liszt. It was not that they copied his style of playing. That was inimitable. Nor did they enjoy close personal contact with him. Not one of them was his pupil. Liszt's influence went deeper than that. It had to do with his unique ability to solve technical problems. Liszt is to piano playing what Euclid is to geometry. Pianists turn to his music in order to discover the natural laws governing the keyboard. It's impossible for a modern pianist to keep Liszt out of his playing, out of his biceps, his forearms, his fingers, even though he may not know that Liszt is there, since modern piano playing spells Liszt. When he was already 30 years old, Busoni began the study of the piano afresh in order to remedy what he considered to be defects in his own playing. He turned to Liszt's music. Out of the laws he found there, Busoni rebuilt his technique. Gratitude and admiration, wrote Busoni, made Liszt at that time my master and my friend."
Wonderful. Absolutely beautiful. And your listeners, you will hear what I'm talking about when I say, when you pick up these biographies, they just flow. This is very much a page-turner that you're reading. Surprisingly, you know, the life of Liszt, I suppose it shouldn't be surprising, but it's, on the one hand, an extremely intelligent approach to his life and work, and a very layered approach, and yet an easy read. It's remarkable. It's a remarkable achievement, Alan Walker. Now, let me remind our listeners, you are tuned in tonight to Artways on 101.5 The Hawk, and I'm Bernadette Ruhl. My guest tonight is music scholar Alan Walker. Alan Walker, early in your career, you worked at the BBC as a music producer, and you said that that experience taught you the difference between the written and the spoken word, as well as, quote, the relationship between words and music. Can you explain what you mean by that?
When I first joined the BBC, I was engaged as a writer I had to write notes for the announcers. It was only later that I became a producer. And when you write for an announcer, you have to become aware of the difference between the spoken and the written word. The spoken word is loose, it is imaginative, it allows for pauses, for reflection, and for inflection. The written word, by contrast, is taut. It's tight. Not a word is lost. The words are there on the printed page, and they're there to stay. The difference between the two, I suppose, comes very much to the forefront if you contrast a novel with a play. I've often been disappointed when I read plays. The words seem to fall lifeless from the page. They have to be brought to life by an actor on the stage. But a good playwright knows this, and he foresees the problems, and he writes in such a way that when his words are read, they come to life.
It is a very different skill.
It's a very different skill. And so I had to write prose that had to be read.
For the BBC announcers.
Yes, I did. Because in those days, they did not make it up as they went along. they had to study the script. I worked with some great names, including people like Alvar Lidell, who went right back to World War II. He was a name to conjure with. He was the BBC. He was the Walter Cronkite of the BBC in those days. And I worked with Alvar for quite a period of time, and he would correct my writing. He would say, no, this is not so easy to speak at the microphone. I would suggest that we change this and we use such and such a phrase. Mm-hmm. And of course, I always took his advice because he'd been there since the flood. and I was not about to argue with him. So I learned a great deal from him. But later, when I became a producer and I wrote words to be published, then I realized that I had to tighten up this prose, this spoken prose, and I had to write in such a way that the words would stay on the page for a considerable time. In fact, it taught me to put aside my own work for at least a month when I was writing the Liszt biography, and then take it out of the drawer, read it again with a fresh eye, and correct it. I became my own editor.
Yes.
So basically, I suppose that's what I meant when I drew attention to the difference between these two types of language.
Okay. Mm. Well, it's evident in your books, as I say. They're very readable. They do flow in a beautiful way. Now, your books about Liszt have won many prizes and a lot of critical acclaim. What would you say is the secret to writing a powerful biography? You're basically looking to gain entry to the inner life of another human being. And as you proved at the beginning of this interview, when you imagined the dinner with Liszt, you're able to do that with him. What do you think is the secret to writing a good biography?
Well, part of the secret is that you have to be enthusiastic. You have to have at least affection towards the subject and possibly even to love the subject. I've always believed that in biography, love opens doors and dislike or hatred closes them. If you write a biography, and such biographies have been written, with dislike in the background, you will never access the innermost recesses of the personality in question. Once you have enthusiasm and your affection for the topic has been aroused, then, of course, it becomes necessary, since you can't make up a biography as you can make up a novel as you go along, you have to follow the paper trail. And that also can lead to eureka moments, moments of great discovery and great enthusiasm. And in the case of Liszt, the paper trails are all over the planet. And so I had to work in Berlin, in Weimar especially, in Budapest, in the secret archives of the Vatican even, in Paris, and of course in several really big archives in America. Thanks to Adolf Hitler, many of Germany's best scholars, music scholars, fled Germany in the 1930s and brought precious manuscripts with them. Mm-hmm. And they've ended up in places like the New York Public Library or the Library of Congress. So they are there to be studied. Mm-hmm. So this is one reason why it took me such a long time to write these books, because I resolved from the very beginning not to make a major statement about Liszt that couldn't be supported with documents. Liszt, you see, had suffered very badly at the hands of his first biographers until, I suppose, right up to World War II. He'd been loosely regarded by the music profession as a whole as a kind of Elvis Presley of the 19th century, someone who was a showman, Someone who was shallow, someone whose music didn't amount to very much, someone who, first and foremost, was a performer and not a composer at all, and someone with basically no posterity worth talking about. What I discovered along the way, of course, was the complete opposite of that, and the paper trail that Liszt had left. More than 10,000 letters, many diaries, manuscripts all over the place. They built up a picture which I think was fairly new, although the Hungarian scholars, I have to say, who were so helpful to me, already had built up their own wonderful picture of Liszt, and I was able to use a great deal of their research when they could not use it, because they were trapped behind the Iron Curtain and couldn't travel.
Right.
So when I made my first visit to Hungary, possibly my very first research visit to the work in the Széchenyi Library in Budapest, they were all very, very welcoming and very helpful to me. So I've always owed them a great debt of gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, I think that probably answers your question. Enthusiasm at the beginning, and then staying power, a refusal to give up,
mm-hmm.
and whatever happens, not to be turned off. And I've always said that in every biography, there's an autobiography trying to get out.
Yes.
And as far as my own biographical, autobiographical experiences are concerned, and by way of showing how stubborn one really has to be, I can just cite in passing my broken foot in Eisenstadt when I was doing research into Liszt's early family background, because he was born in the Austrian Burgenland. My lost luggage going to Weimar, where I was for days without any clothing, change of clothing, and had lost all my notes somewhere in the Schönefeld Airport in East Berlin, being mugged in Budapest, losing all my money, and so on and so forth. And also, to crown everything, being inadvertently locked in the tomb of Goethe and Schiller in Weimar when the lady in charge of the kiosk at the top thought everyone had left, and she locked the doors and left, and I was there by myself. That's another story for another occasion.
Well, actually, I just love that story. You could tell it quickly, couldn't you? I mean, people are going to wonder.
Well, I mean, eventually I was
did.
Released, obviously, otherwise I wouldn't be here. But I had friends in Weimar who were expecting me for dinner, and I had told them that I was going to visit the tombs of Goethe and Schiller, so they knew really where to start their search, and they rescued me.
But tell the listeners what your immediate response to realizing you were locked down there was.
Well, to bring out my notebook and to put down some dates, because you see, all the Grand Dukes of Weimar were pushed aside in their lead caskets. There were about 30 of them, great dukes and grandchildren and duchesses, and they were all identified at the end of the casket, but I didn't have the dates. So there was this wonderful opportunity. And there on the dais, under the spotlights, these rosewood, beautiful caskets, one saying Goethe, the other saying Schiller. I wasn't interested. I just went off into the dusk, into the background, into the cave-like interior with my diary, with my notebook, and I made a note of all the dates, which I think some of them appeared in a Liszt biography for the very first time.
I love this. I mean, this is true dedication. The intrepid biographer trapped in a tomb for possibly the rest of his brief life, thinking, okay, let's get some dates down here. I love that story. All right. Well, Alan Walker, this brings up something, actually, which is a bit of a cheeky question, but you've said that, I forget who you quote, saying that it takes a life to write a life. Who was the originator of that idea?
A research assistant of mine in Hungary, Veronika Vavrinets.
Okay.
She was in charge of the music department in the Széchenyi Library. And on my very first visit to Hungary, and I suppose that would take us back to about 1977, I asked for a meeting with some of the country's leading Liszt scholars, and Veronica was there. I hadn't met her up to that point, and we were a group of perhaps seven or eight, and we met in the Institute of Musicology, and I had a very fruitful meeting with these scholars, all of whom were very enthusiastic that I'd made the journey to go to Hungary, because, as I said earlier, they couldn't travel. And as we were leaving, and I had sort of made my pitch and asked everyone for help and told them what I was about to do, namely to start work on a 3-volume biography of Liszt, which I thought probably I could finish in 3 years because I was a fast writer, Veronika Vavrinets came up to me and she said, remember, it takes a life to study a life. And that was about the best piece of advice anyone, or the best warning that anyone could have given me. Yeah. And had anyone at that point said, it may not take a life, but it's going to take 25 years, I might have caught the next plane home.
Yeah, seriously. Well, okay, the cheeky question I have for you in that context is, has it taken your life? You're still writing about Liszt. I mean, what has it cost you in terms of your own life?
It's cost me nothing. In fact, it's added immeasurably to my life. I can't imagine my life without writing, and certainly I can't imagine my writing life without writing about Liszt. I've learned so much on my travels. I've met so many interesting people, and I wouldn't give up a single week, let alone a year, that I spent writing about Liszt. It's been absolutely marvelous. So I don't regard this as a sacrifice, although when good people such as yourself say, my goodness, it took him 25 years. What a sacrifice. For me, it was not a sacrifice at all. It was a privilege.
It was what you wanted to be doing.
Yes.
Wonderful answer, of course. All right. Now, was there ever a moment when you were writing about Liszt that gave you pause? Was there ever a time when you just questioned your right to delve any further into an intimate incident or a private moment? Or did you just feel, I am going to completely inhabit his life and give it to the world?
Well, this is a very deep and a very interesting question. In the case of a personality like Liszt, he belongs to history. And therefore, anything goes. And if you discover something that might have made him feel embarrassed or uncomfortable or even ashamed during his lifetime, then perhaps one would be given pause. One would say, perhaps it's not a good idea to mention this. Let's wait until Liszt dies, and then we can talk about it. But this is a problem that faces every biographer. If you're writing about a living person, you have to be very careful how you treat the subject. But if you're writing about someone who's famous and dead, they belong to history, and therefore really you can write about any aspect of this person's life and work, however uncomfortable, however embarrassing, however unexpected it might be. I mean, at the moment I've just been reading about a life of Chopin, and I came across the confession made by Chopin's sister, Ludwika, mm-hmm. which remained in the archives, well, until recent times. And had anyone during Ludwika's lifetime, she died in 1855 or thereabouts, had they come across this document, they would have regarded it as an absolutely shameful attack on the Chopin family. But she attacks her husband, Calasanti, for his behavior toward Chopin during Chopin's dying weeks. Her husband was insanely jealous of Chopin, and Ludwika decided to write this so-called confession, which was never published during her lifetime, obviously. It was published by Polish scholars in recent times. So that would be an example of something perhaps better left unsaid during the lifetime or near the lifetime of the person in question. But after 100 years, it really doesn't matter. It belongs to history.
With time, everything is to be revealed. Okay, very interesting. Is it the man that compels you, or is it his music?
Well, it's both. Liszt would not be the same without his music, and the music would be unimaginable without the man who composed it. So the way I've approached this, I've opened myself to both these influences, the music and the man. Having said that, it was certainly the man who attracted me first. As a small child, I used to spend my pocket money in England on these little 15-page pamphlets, biographies, published by Novello, the publishing house Novello, The Lives of the Great Composers. And the life of Liszt really fascinated me, even though I was so young. And I, at that point, had not come across the Third Liebestraum and the Second Hungarian Rhapsody.
No.
But I was riveted by the picture of Liszt the man that emerged from these few pages. And then, of course, I came across the music. But normally, it happens the other way around.
Mm-hmm,
I think this is a fairly common experience that you hear, just keeping the conversation in the field of music for a moment, you hear a piece of music, and you think, I like that, and you hear it again, and you think, well, who composed that?
Mm-hmm.
And then when was it composed? What nationality was this person? And so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And gradually, by answering all these questions that arise from falling in love with a piece of music, you're halfway towards a biography. So the one stimulates the other.
Mm. Okay, but you must have read other little pamphlets from Novello of other composers, and none of the others had quite the grip on you as the one on Liszt?
Well, you know, Liszt led such a colorful life that even if you report the facts, you can be accused of writing fiction.
True enough.
It's true that Beethoven and I suppose to some extent Mozart and other composers, Schumann, they led very, very interesting lives.
Oh, yeah.
I'm avoiding Brahms because I always find him a little dour and a little boring.
Well, he wasn't crazy about Liszt, right?
But he was a great composer, of course, but I think I would find that biography rather hard to write because there are no... or rather few dramatic moments. But in the case of Liszt, his life just jumps off the page, and you think that can't be true. He really couldn't have done that, but it turns out to be usually an understatement.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, Alan Walker, you've been accused by Harold Schoenberg of the New York Times of having fallen in love with Franz Liszt. Is this true?
It's not only true, I regard it as a compliment. But Harold himself regarded it as a criticism. I call Harold Schoenberg Harold because we ended up as great friends. And when I was chair of the music department here at McMaster University, I brought him in as a visiting professor for 3 months. And so we got to know one another very well. And we were not only able to talk a great deal about Liszt, but a great deal about all three reviews that he had written about my three volumes. And he then... I think he somewhat modified his view because I made the same point to him that I made to you a little earlier in the program, that if you don't love the subject, you're going to be denied access. It's a strange psychological feeling because if you're drawn to a topic through love, through affection, through fascination, psychologically, doors suddenly open, mm-hmm. and you see things in that life, in that personality, that would otherwise remain mm-hmm. unknown to you because you approach the topic with closed doors. And I think, I can't put words into Harold's mouth, of course, he's no longer with us, but the fact is that I think he ended up agreeing with me that enthusiasm basically is the key, and to love is to know, or to know is to love, mm-hmm. however you want to express this. You know what I'm trying to say, because it works not only in biography, but in other walks of life.
Yes, of course. Mm. One of your teachers placed Liszt somewhere between Beethoven and Paganini in the pantheon of classical musicians, and you say, I read this somewhere, that you wish you had asked, how close to Beethoven? How close to Beethoven would you put Liszt?
Well, closer than I would put him to Paganini. Of course, Liszt is often dismissed as the Paganini of the piano. Paganini was a great showman, a wonderful virtuoso, probably the greatest violinist that we've ever seen in history. But Liszt was much more than a virtuoso. Mm-hmm. So I would place him much closer to Beethoven than to Paganini. By the way, that comment, somewhere between Beethoven and Paganini, came from my teacher, Hans Keller. He could have been a Paganini enthusiast because Hans Keller was a violinist by training, so he knew a great deal about Paganini.
Okay.
But I think he probably meant it as a mild criticism that I was even bothering to spend so much of my life writing a biography of Liszt. Mm-hmm. Although, having said that, when the first volume was published, Hans Keller regarded it so highly that he made a bet with me, a private bet. He bet that it would win the Yorkshire Post Music Prize. And I said, there's no way this could possibly happen. So we put £5 each on the bet. He was betting for the book. I was betting against it. And he drew up a formal betting contract, which today is in my personal archive at McMaster University, if anyone wants to go there and look at it. And of course, he won the bet because I did get the Yorkshire Post Music Prize.
Yes, and you've got it twice, didn't you?
Yes, I got it for the first volume and for the third volume. And I can hear Hans Keller now saying, what happened to the second volume?
What were you doing in the middle there? Okay, well, while we're on Hans Keller, he once advised you to stop when you still have something more to say. You said that
yes.
was wonderful advice.
This was actually advice to overcome writer's block, which affects, I suppose, the best of writers. And it's a terrifying thing when you know you have something to say and you simply can't fill the page. You simply seize up. And his advice was always to stop writing when you still have something to say, because the next time... you open up the computer or pick up your pen or get out of bed, have your first cup of coffee and go back to your work desk, that unsaid idea will be there waiting to be articulated, and it will bring in its train other things.
Sure.
So the writing process will be drawn in after it.
It'll prime the pump.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. I thought that was a bit of advice given for writing a good piece. Mm-hmm. Don't tell everything that you know.
It certainly could work that way. You could regard it as such, but Hans meant it as a method of overcoming writer's block.
Okay. All right. Now, you're also very close to the great pianist, and we're so lucky to have her around the Hamilton area, Valerie Tryon. Can you tell me what you've learned about Liszt from her? I know she's passionate about Liszt as well.
Well, I would like to regard this as a symbiotic relationship. Valerie was playing Liszt long before she met me, and I was writing about Liszt before I met her.
So
now
we have
a very good professional relationship, and she often invites me over to listen to her programs before she plays them in public. And by the same token, I sometimes give her chapters that I've written so that she can comment on my chapters, particularly when it's about Liszt. Mm-hmm. So basically, we learn from one another. But it would be a mistake to suppose, as some commentators have, that Valerie was brought to Liszt because of my work, or I was brought to my work because of Valerie's Liszt playing.
Okay.
It didn't quite happen like that.
Okay, a fair enough point. But has she taught you things by listening to the way she plays Liszt? Have you learned?
Oh, yes, I've always admired her Liszt playing. In fact, I was one of her main producers at the BBC many, many years ago. And the aristocratic poise and detachment, and I mean this as a compliment, the arm's length approach to Liszt is what serves him best. You see, Liszt music is filled with rhetoric. It's filled with drama. And if you have a pianist who's playing, whose stylistic approach to the keyboard is rhetorical, whose playing is filled with drama, and he comes to Liszt, that's enough to push this music over the brink into the abyss of vulgarity, if I can use that expression. What Liszt actually requires in order to have this music sound at its best is the same approach that a field marshal might have directing his troops in battle. He doesn't go in the front line in the mud and the gore with a bayonet and hand-to-hand fighting. He's 100 miles behind the battle, directing everything from afar. There are great Liszt players who are like that. They hardly seem to do anything. They just let Liszt music speak for itself. And when that happens, when you have a pianist who can play everything technically, but doesn't really interfere interpretatively with the music, then the music sounds at its best. You can put too much of yourself into Liszt, and then it can simply sound vulgar. You can overdo it. Some of the great Liszt players of the past, I suppose, would be Egon Pátry, Dino Lipatti, certainly Mozejewicz. It's not a long list, but there are enough records of these pianists to teach us that Liszt music sounds at its best when played by a pianist who is also a musical aristocrat.
Okay.
And not a mere peasant.
All right.
And of course, Valerie is an aristocrat.
Valerie is an aristocrat for sure. She's no peasant. All right. Now, if you were offered the chance, Alan Walker, to start over with no memories, and the choice was to be Alan Walker or Franz Liszt, which would you choose and why?
Alan Walker, I'd choose to be myself, because then I could write about Liszt.
You absolutely are, what can I say? I love it. Okay, we're almost at the end of the program, sadly. I want you to tell me what piece of music you've chosen for us to close the program with tonight and why this one, and I know it's going to be Liszt.
The choice is unusual. I mean, Liszt, he wrote more than 1,400 individual works, and some of them are extremely long, like the Oratorio Christus, three and a half hours, and the Faust Symphony, nearly an hour. But I've chosen a piano piece, which is one of Liszt's masterworks. It's not necessarily in the standard repertory. That is to say, you wouldn't hear it every day in the concert hall. It's not like the B minor piano sonata of Liszt or the Liebestraum and many other works that one could think of. It's called Benediction de Dieu dans la solitude, the benediction of God in solitude. It's a wonderful piece of romanticism. It shows Liszt at his best, at his greatest. And I've chosen the recording, a very early recording, made in the late 1930s by Louis Kentner, the great Hungarian Liszt player. Louis Kentner, as a young man, left Hungary, I suppose, in 1933, and he settled in England. And he became extremely well-known, making records and playing on BBC Radio. And that's where I met him. And I produced a number of his recitals. And so this particular performance of Benediction, played by Louis Kentner, brings back many happy memories. I'm very familiar with his style of playing. There's an old saying that inside every great pianist is a singer trying to get out. Sometimes, of course, he does get out, and then the results can be unfortunate. But I mean singing through the keyboard. And this bel canto style was very much a part of Louis Kentner's artistic makeup. And it comes out in this piece of music, Benediction de Dieu. The piece of music, we'll only have time to hear about 5 minutes of it, is composed in the key of F sharp major. And those musicologists who have taken an interest in this topic would understand that the key of F sharp major for Liszt is a very special key. He nearly always goes to F sharp major, which is six sharps in the key signature, when he's thinking of something divine, when he's in touch with God, when he's thinking in biblical terms. Because Liszt, as you know, he was not only a devout Roman Catholic all his life, but he ended up as a priest. We haven't really had time to talk about that at all.
Right.
When he was in his early 50s, he took the lower orders of the priesthood. And so much of his music is inspired by his Catholicism. And this particular work is a deeply religious piece, but it's also a great piece of romantic piano music. And that's one reason I thought it would be appropriate to end the program with it.
Well, I can hardly wait to hear it. I want to hear this wonderful Hungarian pianist, Louis Kentner, singing at the keyboard. And I want to hear what you call the spiritual depths of Liszt's faith. And I want to hear the romanticism as well. And perhaps faith and romanticism have a lot in common. I guess they're linked. Anyway, this is, I think it sounds like an absolutely wonderful choice. I just had one more quick question for you, or actually requires a quick answer. You're a very prolific writer, Alan Walker. I do not know how you do everything that you do. Do you have a specific regimen that you follow every day, a particular time in the morning at the computer?
Yes, I write every day. I write in the morning. I'm basically incapable of writing after lunch, but sometimes if I'm under pressure of a deadline, for example, I will do that. But normally I write after my first cup of coffee. I go down now to my computer, and I'll try to write sometimes for 3 hours with a break. If I can't write for 3 hours, I'll write for two. If not for two, then for one. But I hardly ever let a day go past without writing. I like to keep the wheels well-oiled, so to say. Because if you stop writing, I think it's rather difficult to pick it up again.
Yes.
But I've never had that problem. I've written every day. And even today, before coming into the studio, I put in 3 hours' work this morning. Now, whether I live with those words, whether I keep them, that's another matter.
Yes.
I will go over everything and perhaps reduce everything in size. But but I'm always pen in hand. I have to say that the first volume of my Liszt biography was written entirely in longhand, on children's multicolored jumbo pads. The volume two was written on an IBM Selectric typewriter, and volume three, I'd become computer savvy, and I was using a word processor.
Little so by little.
I've lived through this this age of technological revolution.
Wonderful. Well, it has been such a delight to have you on the program tonight, Alan Walker. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And we thank you for listening in. You are now going to hear this wonderful, or at least the first third of this wonderful piece by Louis Kentner, well, by Liszt, played by Louis Kentner, the Benediction de Dieu dans la solitude, and hope that you'll be able to join me next week when my guest will be the writer Ellen Jaffe. But until then, this is Bernadette Rule wishing you a good night. Thank you.
Thank you.